For those or some of you who have just arrived, who have not followed what has been going on so far, this morning we spoke about spiritual ambition. We saw the vital importance that the whole course and direction of our life should be changed, and changed so completely that the carnal ambitions that we once had, we now abandon. And we are renewed in our minds, as Paul said in Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds. Have you ever wondered when you talk to some Christians what's so different about them from the non-Christian? They seem to be simply non-Christians dressed up in Christian clothing. They seem to be nothing particularly Christian. They just know how to talk evangelical verbiage, but there doesn't seem to be anything remarkably different from their way of thinking. You all are familiar with those elders of churches and those pastors who, after the service, they have a little mahjong game somewhere in the New Territories. They reserve their little table in that restaurant there. Everybody knows these stories. They're going around all the time. And it's sometimes painful to hear the conversation between pastors. They're so interested in the things of this world. There's no great change in their thinking. Their ambition has not yet become spiritual. And what are they doing in God's work? Our whole mind must be transformed. Our thinking must be renewed. To become a new creature means not just that somehow our label has changed. It means that the inner substance has changed. Our whole way of thinking has changed. I would like to ask you whether you have changed since becoming Christian. Whether your whole way of thinking has changed, your attitude towards people, your attitude towards life. If not, then there's a lot to think about, whether or not you're really a Christian, or whether you're still pursuing the world, whether you still belong, after all, to the world and not yet to Christ. You cannot belong to both at the same time. Now, somebody might say, oh, that's very nice. I just hear you saying this. I seem to see you driving a great big car outside there. Sure, I do drive a big car. The car doesn't belong to me, though. It's worth your knowing that the car belongs to the church in case anybody gets ideas. Sometimes, you know, before making judgments or passing judgments on people, it is well worth finding out what the facts are. And when you found out the facts, the things turn out to be very different from what they appear to be. But we noticed, we saw this morning, the importance of spiritual ambition. And we need to change. God must change us more and more. That the spiritual things become more and more significant to us. The things of this world, they just fade away. You know, this applies also in so many Christians, that they think that they can do the things of this world for the sake of Christ. There is a snare there. That I can get more honor for myself in this world and say that it was for Christ's sake. That sounds a rather good way to get around it, isn't it? You see, if the non-Christian is going for worldly honor and for worldly position and for more and more degrees, you say, these guys always run after the world. But when the Christian does exactly the same thing, he says it's for the Lord, you see. You know, we must once and for all be saved from this kind of hypocrisy, because we fool no one except ourselves. The non-Christian says, you hypocrites. You do exactly the same thing as we do, and then you say it's for the Lord. I bought a big house, right? But it's for the Lord. You see, because I can get more people meeting in my house. The non-Christian buys a big house, you say, you love the world. The Christian buys a big house and he says it's for the Lord. How convenient. All we need is to pass everything to the Lord. And so the non-Christian buys a big car, you say, worldly. You see, that's how non-Christians are. And a Christian buys a big car and you say, I needed to take people to church with me. Oh, everything is so convenient. And then you, the non-Christian, pursues after one degree and another and getting worldly glory, you see. The non-Christian, he's just like that. And so what are you doing it for? You're also pursuing one degree after. Oh, no. That's for the Lord, you see. My degrees are all for the Lord. Oh, that's just right. That's just beautiful. How handy to have the Lord around to help you to buy a big car, to help you to get a big house, to help you to get all your degrees. I mean, you have an advantage over the non-Christian. The poor guy has nobody to pray to when he's facing the exams. And when you face the exam, praise God, you can pray to him. That's just nice. You see, we better examine our thinking to see whether it's really been renewed. or whether we are fooling ourselves by what I have called evangelical verbiage, by means of which we can deceive ourselves so effectively that we are actually convinced by the truth of it. I ask you, when you have got your so many degrees, I ask you, how exactly does the glory and the honor belong to God? Does he get the degree, or do you get the degree? Who gets the degree anyway? If Jesus got the degree, then he gets the honor. If you get the degree, I don't quite see how he got the honor. You say, well, you see, I'm going to use it for God. Well, that's exactly the same argument. I'm going to use this big car for God. I'm going to use the big house for God. Everything is for God. So the non-Christian can't have it. Or if he has it, he should be criticized. The Christian has it, it's just right. I'm not sure I understand this kind of reasoning. It rather puzzles me. Can you work it out? I need your help to think this one through. How to work this thing out. Now, I'm not saying that Christians should therefore should cease from their education, that we should all be illiterate, because that's most glorifying to God. What I'm saying is, by all means, do what you need to do, but don't go using God as an excuse for doing it. You can very well study. Every Christian should have a profession. It's right. It's good. Why shouldn't he have a profession? It's the proper thing, the scriptural teaching. Every person should have a profession. But you don't need to use God as an excuse for that. The non-Christian doesn't need to use an excuse. You don't need an excuse. If you go on to do a master's, there's nothing wrong with that, if that is the way you see it right before God. But you don't have to use God as an excuse either. And if you go on to a PhD, there is no sin in that either. But brothers and sisters, don't use God as an excuse. Just leave God out of it. Just say, I see it is right for me to get this PhD and to do whatever job is to do. And in that area, I will try to live for God's glory. Certainly, I will seek to do it. But don't say, I'm going to get the PhD for God's glory. You know why I'm saying that? I'm criticizing myself. Yes, I'm hitting myself. I'm giving myself black eyes in saying this. I myself pursued in exactly that way, saying, I'm going to get this degree for God's glory. And so ambitious was I in this area that, in fact, before I even finished my, when I was still doing my undergraduate course in theology, I was already writing my doctoral thesis. And I had just about finished the doctoral thesis in theology before I even graduated from the undergraduate course. You imagine that? I had written over 340 pages in a doctoral thesis on the subject of the doctrine of salvation, which I was going to submit to the University of Zurich in Switzerland for the doctorate in theology. And you know, I said to myself, all this is for God's glory. It's for Him. And exactly what I'm sharing with you is what God convicted me of. I remember walking up and down in Cambridge one day, and God was saying, I'm not going to let you go through with this. And I said, why not? This is for you. The Lord said, is it for me or for you? Let's get this thing straightened out. And you know, so utterly deceived was I that I was absolutely convinced it was for God. I said, it's sure for you. He said, think again. I said, but sure. He said, think again. I struggled on and on until I realized, who gets the doctorate? Me. Not God. But you say, he'll be glorified in you. No, no, he's not glorified in you. You are glorified in yourself. But you know, this line of thinking is so difficult for us to adjust to, isn't it? I have talked to so many young people, they have gone to theological college, and they always assure me that it is for God that they are getting their degrees. I wish that God would open their eyes to see really what is the truth of the matter. In all honesty, stop deceiving ourselves. And though the University of Zurich had accepted me into the faculty for the doctorate of theology, to this day I have never submitted the thesis. I cannot submit it because God showed me that this is not the way I should go about it. Today those 340 pages of manuscript, photostated, and double copies still sit in my drawers. God is saying to me, will you serve me without the recognition, the glory of men? You see, this morning we're speaking about spiritual ambition. We want the praise of men because we think the praise of men to us will bring praise to God. That is the logic. If men praise us, it follows that the praise to me will be praise to God. Think about it again. Are you sure? If that is the case, we should all go for the praise of men. What we spoke about this morning, what the Lord Jesus said in John, was all wrong. How can you believe who seek glory from men? But we think that we seeking glory from men is good, because if we get the glory, it's God who gets the glory. You see how we have twisted up the whole business? So teaching that what Jesus said was wrong. We are, after all, to be going for worldly ambition, because the worldly ambition, the worldly success is going to prove to God's glory. How do you work this out? So the more glory I get, the more success I get, the more glory God gets. On this logic, brothers and sisters, then what the Lord Jesus said this morning was all wrong. He said, you must go and get glory and praise for men, because in that praise and glory you get from men, God will be glorified. That's our evangelical logic of this 20th century. That is the accepted statement through all the churches. And here I come along and I make everybody uncomfortable. I upset the apple cart and say, this is wrong. I say, dear me, just now I was feeling comfortable. Just now I was going on nicely, doing everything and getting the praise of men. I was getting all these things. I was getting my big car for the glory of God, my big house for the glory of God, my degrees for the glory of God. And you come along and tell me that this is not right. I didn't come along to tell you anything. I just told you what Jesus said. On your reasoning and on your logic, we must go for more praise from men. Every Christian, work hard from today and tomorrow, whenever you get back to work, and get plenty of praise from men. Everybody praise you. Say, wow, he is wonderful. He is marvelous. You say, and oh, God gets all the praise. I ask you, how does God get the praise? Exactly how? Just how does he get the praise? When I have a PhD, you look at me and think, wow, this marvelous guy, doctor of theology from the famous University of Zurich. Where does God get the praise? It stopped here. Don't kid ourselves. Let's not fool ourselves, brothers and sisters. Think this out in your mind clearly. The Lord Jesus says, if you seek the praise of men, you are not going to get the praise of God. But how can we not seek the praise of men if the praise of men redounds to the glory of God that we get? The praise of men that we get. Do you see, that is evangelical reasoning. We must get more praise from men. If you do your job beautifully, everybody praises you, God gets the glory. How does it work out? Think about it. You need to be a logician to be a Christian, huh? Well, if in this conference we are dealing with fundamentals, it's good. Because what's happening is this. We are beginning to change our whole outlook on life. Not until we learn to think correctly is God going to use us. Are we able to fight the spiritual warfare? Think of the logic like this. If John Stone had reasoned in this way, and he said, well, I'm going to accept the chair of chemistry in the University of Nanking, because this is to the glory of God that I'm doing it. And everybody says, look, John Song, professor of chemistry in the University of Nanking, he is a Christian. Everybody's going to believe in God. Well, why doesn't John Song do this thing then? Why not? Instead, he does the most stupid thing you have ever heard of in your life. He turns down the chair of chemistry. I hope you know what the chair of chemistry is. I think everybody at university students here. I don't know whether that's an English term or American term. I'm not very sure whether I'm speaking English terms or American terms. The chair, of course, is the chief position in the English universities of any department. The highest position means the person in charge of the department has the chair of that department. He is the. And Johnson was often offered that primary position. Do you think John Song, shouldn't he have accepted that? Don't you think that how many people in that age when science was so exalted were turned to God because John Song, professor of chemistry? Instead, he becomes a poor pastor. Instead, he becomes a nobody. And he goes around the countryside preaching to little churches here and there, having opposition from other Christians. Some of them regarding him as mad, others regarding him as demon-possessed. How exalted if he had only been in the chair of Nanking. Instead, he goes around. Oh, you say, well, look at him, how God used him. But you have the benefit of hindsight. You only know it now because you look back and said, yes, John Sung did the right thing, but don't use an unfair argument. Look at it at the beginning, when he had the choice of doing one of two things. Going out and being an unknown preacher when nobody ever heard of John Tsong at that time. Or going and becoming the chair, instantly famous, of Nanking's university. Which would you have done, brothers and sisters? I don't think I will miss the answer if I know which one you will do. If you were offered the chair of any department, I'm sure you'll jump in it. You'll take the chair, the bed, and everything else. Anything that they have to offer around there. Strange. What did John Tsong do here? Do we understand it? He chose the hard road. He chose the road of being nobody. He went out and preached the gospel with no paraphernalia, no titles, nothing. He just went out and preached the gospel. We must do God's work and fight spiritual battles in God's way. Because so many people meant well to serve God and ended up nowhere because they did not understand the spiritual principles of spiritual warfare. It's not good enough to mean well. It's important to do the thing in the right way. So many Christians, they mean well and they end up nowhere because they didn't understand the principles of God's work. You know, I am not saying that God cannot use you if in one day you are going to become professor of chemistry or whatever it may be. God certainly can use you. I do not say that you may not become any of these things. Scripture does not allow me to say so. You have every right. Every right to become, to take the chair take the chair of any department. But I am saying, if you intend to serve the Lord and bring glory to Him, don't go about it in the wrong way. You are academics, most of you anyway, as far as the world regards. Undergraduates are not regarded as very academic by graduates. But let us say that you are going to all end up one day as graduates. I trust most of you will anyway. But learn to serve God in the right way. Only in the path of the cross will you ever be able to serve God effectively. And that we are going to talk about tomorrow morning in greater detail. I want to share with you a lesson that I learned so powerfully through a great friend of mine, still a great friend. I don't think he will mind if I mention his name. A professor in London, Professor Fairbairn. I knew him when he was still a lecturer, or what in this country would have been called, I believe, an associate professor or something of this kind. I knew him in those days, and he loved the Lord very much. He was already a very distinguished scientist. And we became very good friends. He always made a point of witnessing to his students. He always made a point of serving the Lord, never missing an opportunity. And as he went up and up in the scale. And he went up into the heights of England's academic society. From the PhD, which he had to start with, which was the minimum anyway. He went on to the Doctorate of Science, DSC, which is an honorary doctorate. He went on to the highest prize in all English, among all English, all British scientists, the FRS, the Fellow of the Royal Society. He was loaded with honors for his research, crowded with the praise of men, distinguished throughout the world. His textbooks, I believe, are still read, and his contributions to his particular science are still read by people who are studying the subject today. He went all over the world lecturing on his subject and taking opportunity to witness for Christ. He was often invited to speak at various meetings and conferences simply because he was quite a good speaker. And one day after a particular meeting, he opened his heart to me as I was taking him to the station. He said, "Eric," he said, "I would really like to share something with you." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I feel so bitterly disappointed." I said, "Why?" He said, "You know, Eric," he says, "I do love the Lord." I said, "I know that." He said, "I make it my point to serve Him in whatever way I can." I said, "I know that too." He said, "But you know, one thing I don't understand is why God is not pleased to use me." I said, "Why do you say that?" He said, "Well, I preach the gospel, but nothing ever happens." I teach, and nobody seems to be instructed. I try to reach my students, and nothing happens. He said, I just feel so discouraged. Well, I tried to comfort him at the time, and I wondered in my mind why this was so. He is a good speaker. He was a truly Christian man. He was one who loved the Lord. Why was this so? I wondered in my mind. Until I understood the scriptural principle of service. The scriptural principle of service is this, brothers and sisters, that not until we have learned to die to ourselves, not until that means, dying to ourselves, means turning our back on the world as John Song did, will God be too pleased to use us in full measure. I don't say God didn't use him in any way, but he did not get the results that he so longed for, that he so desired, which he seemed so well to deserve. He did not get them. It was a mystery to him and a mystery to me at the time. I could not figure it out because no one could be more eloquent than he was. No one more fluent. No one more pleasing a speaker. No one who could put his subject together more beautifully. In preaching the gospel, brothers and sisters, it is a matter of power. The power that comes from above. It is not a question of eloquence. It's not the question of your style. It's not the question of how you behave in the platform, whether you jump up and down like John Song or you stand stock still like a piece of wood. It has nothing to do with it. It has a question to do with the power from above that God chooses to use you or he doesn't use you. You can be the most eloquent man on the face of the earth, most learned, most distinguished, and God doesn't want to look at you. You can talk your mouth dry. You can preach until you're absolutely exhausted. And God doesn't look at you. Nothing happens whatsoever. The secret of service. And I'm sure many people are far better speakers than John Song, better preachers whose Chinese was better, their English is better, everything is better. And why does God choose to use him and not the other person? It was precisely for this secret that I studied John Song's biography, seeking to learn something. And he told me, he tells his own story exactly thus. He said his secret lies in this, that he loves God with a devotion that nobody can exceed, and with a devotion that does not consist in the abundance of words, but in the action that turns its back upon the world, that, like Paul, turned his back upon the world and threw the whole thing away. He said, all the things that I counted gain, I now realize was not gain, it was loss. And therefore, I have thrown the whole thing away as rubbish and regarded as so much dung. Well, why can't you have both? There's no. What you regard as gain, remember the principle we saw this morning? That will be lost to you. What you lose, you gain. Is that difficult for you to understand? Think it through. What you cling to is going to become a hindrance to you. What you lose is going to become a blessing to you. Why can't we serve God and have the other thing? You can. After a fashion. God doesn't choose to use you. It doesn't work that way, brothers and sisters. It doesn't work. I don't mean to say that God will not use you at all. That was not the statement we have said. But that your power will be so reduced that the amount of blessing that comes through you becomes quite minimal. And so I share with you this spiritual principle that unless you die, you will not live. John chapter 12, we saw this morning in that verse. That if a man loves his life, he will lose it. But except a grain of wheat, which is us, fall into the ground and die. How do you die? Die to this world means you have lost, you have given up all the claims you have made upon this world. Oh, that's a high price. It's a high price, a costly price. You see, as we mentioned this morning, I could also take up a lectureship in some university and preach the gospel from time to time. At a conference or at a meeting. Why not? Why can't I do that? What's there to stop me? Nothing. But you know why I do not do it? Because I know that I end up with nothing. I know that I'll end up with nothing, spiritually speaking. I know that it must be all. That's what Christ says. Take up your cross. You cannot have something. You cannot have the hope of accomplishing much for God at little cost. You see, spiritual power is bought at a very high price, if I can put it in that way. The pearl of great price, to obtain it, costs everything. If it doesn't cost everything, you don't get it. No way. The pearl of great price costs everything to get. Is it sad to give up everything? No, because it's the pearl of great price we get. The question depends on your spiritual perception. If you see how precious it is, then it is not the cost that bothers you, that worries you. You say, what is the cost? I always remember how after Brother William, Reverend Yu, gave up his electrical engineering to serve the Lord, how many people said to him, even in my presence, oh, what a cost you have paid to serve the Lord. And I remember his almost indignant reply, what cost? Oh, he said, what cost? The cost of electrical engineering. You gave up your bachelor's, you gave up your master's, everything you gave up to preach the gospel. And I must say that his witness spoke something to me as he said, what cost? What is the cost? To get the pearl of great price, what is a bachelor of science? What is a master of science? What is any of these things? What cost? Right, what cost? When you have seen what is ahead, when you've got the spiritual ambition, when you have seen the beauty of Christ, and you ask Paul, what a cost you have paid. Look at this, Paul. You could have been professor in Jerusalem. You would have been a member of the Sanhedrin. Maybe he already was one. And you end up preaching the gospel. Poor man, kicked about, regarded as the scum of the earth, the dregs of society. He uses the very word, the offscoring of all things, the rubbish. Paul says, what cost? What cost? It's that I may gain him. It's worth it. That little tribulation, he says, that we suffer now is nothing in comparison to that which we shall obtain. It's nothing by comparison, nothing to talk about in terms of cost. So remember this. In spiritual warfare, to fight and win, to serve effectively, you must know the principle of the seed. Always remember that unless you fall into the ground and die, that is, die to the world and become alive to God, fully alive to God, fully dead to the world, only then will you bring forth much fruit. Oh, may God cause us to understand this. That is what we mean, the basic principle of spiritual ambition, that once we have caught the vision that the world is passing away, but He abides forever, then we pursue after Him. Our whole ambition is to obtain Him. And we have constantly used this word ambition, and we have seen throughout the New Testament this morning how it is. And there are other references which I have not quoted to you. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, Paul uses exactly the word ambition in the original. I believe the RSV once more translates it by the word aim. Ambition is the word. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9. So whether we be in the body or out of the body, we make it our ambition to please Him. Oh, marvelous words. My ambition is to please Christ. Is that your ambition? Your aim in life? Your purpose? He uses again the same word ambition, and this time the RSV translates it correctly by ambition in Romans chapter 15 and verse 20. What does Paul say here? I make it my ambition to preach the gospel wherever Christ has not been preached before. I make it my ambition to preach the gospel. What kind of ambition have you got? Is that your ambition? The ambition to please Christ, whether in the body or out of it, dead or alive, in other words. My ambition is to please Christ. My ambition is to preach the gospel to all those who need it. Here Paul uses the very word, ambition. Now in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 20, many of you may have been studying this passage, we find this ambition here again. Chapter 2 and verse 20, and we have not much time to stop with it. We read these words, 2 Timothy 2:20. In a great house there are not only vessels of gold and vessels and silver, but also of wood and earthenware, and some for noble use and some for ignoble use. Verse 21. If anyone purifies himself, notice these words, if anyone purifies himself, it's something that you must do, and don't wait for God to do it. It doesn't say wait till God purifies you. If anyone purifies himself from what is ignoble Then he will be a vessel for noble use, consecrated and useful to the master of the house, ready for any good work. There again, the same principle of spiritual ambition. You see, God has not predestined us to be either a vessel of wood or earthenware, or predestined us, on the one hand, to be vessels of gold or silver. If that's the case, there is nothing more to do. If that is already being settled, there's no point any more striving or having spiritual ambition. But he says no. If you purify yourself, then you are going to become a vessel of gold or silver. This is what you can do. You can aspire to it. First Timothy, it says, if anyone aspires to the office of a bishop, that is, of an overseer, a pastor, he has desired a good thing. Why? Because he desires to serve the church. That's what the pastor is there for, to serve. As the Lord Jesus says in Mark 10:45, Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. This great house, this temple of God, in the temple of God, there are all kinds of utensils. There were golden utensils that were used in the holy place, and in the holiest place of all. There were golden things, especially in the holy place. There were the golden candlesticks, the golden plate for the showbread, golden objects which were in the holiest place of all. But further out, there were great big earthenware jars where people could wash their hands or wash the sacrificial pots. There were wooden utensils also for scraping things, for containing things. There were wooden utensils which were used because they were less susceptible to uncleanness under the law. But I shall not bother to explain that now. Which in the temple of God, which are you going to be? It hasn't been predetermined. We saw this morning, we all start out at the same starting point. It's where we finish that will be different. We all start out at the same point, but we are going to end up some as vessels of gold, some of silver, some of wood, some of earthenware. Which are you going to be? That is the reason why we've got to run the race to obtain. You are going to decide your place in the kingdom of God. You do well to think about it. It is exceedingly significant. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul says that he has laid a foundation, which is Christ. No other foundation can that be laid than which is already laid, namely Jesus Christ. And then he goes on to mention something which so many Christians can't understand. And why should it be hard to understand? By the time you know the principle of spiritual ambition, it's very easy to understand. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and verse 11, which is the verse I just read, of Christ being the foundation. Verse 12. Now if anyone builds on the foundation, which is Christ, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, whichever it will be, each man's work will become manifest. What are you building with? Gold, hay, or stubble? What are you building with? Now notice, the gold is the costliest of all. The hay costs nothing. You see what I just mentioned about cost? It is the cost to accomplish something spiritually. In the spiritual world, everything that is precious is costly to obtain. And so what you build with depends on how much cost you are prepared to pay out. Oh, brothers and sisters, this principle is so exceedingly important. And then in 2 Timothy, in the passage we just read, it says you must purify yourself. How to purify yourself, that you may be vessels of gold and silver, etc. And don't come back with false modesty again, please. And say, well, it's all right to be a wooden utensil, a vessel of earthenware. I mean, they all have their uses, isn't it? I mean, after all, you need these things. Why need these things? It'd be perfectly all right in the temple if everything were made of gold. But that is false humility. I am quite willing to be the small things, the insignificant things. Nobody talked about small and insignificant things. We only talked about the quality. And you are saying you are willing to be low quality, that's good enough. You need low quality things too, not only high quality things. Some people say, well, you need soldiers in an army too. You can't all be officers. Well, that's perfect logic. Why not? I think it's fine if everybody were officers. It's fine with me. So the point here is this, we mustn't confuse ourselves with mock humility. Here we are talking about quality, not about station, or the quality of what you offer to God. What is it? Now, why do we emphasize all this? What has all this got to do with guidance? It has everything to do with guidance. You know why? It is not surprising that in a church today that knows nothing about guidance is the same church that knows nothing about spiritual ambition. Don't you see the connection? And so there is endless confusion. How do I get guidance? How do you get guidance to become a vessel of gold? We are told already. But you see, when we come to the matter of guidance, once you understand the principle, it's so simple that it doesn't take a lot of time to expound. And I don't know what these great books are for that tell you about guidance. To know the will of God, you have to look at some external circumstances, some internal circumstances, some this circumstances and that circumstances. What is this talking about? Where in the Bible do you read such things? Where did they invent this thing from? Guidance has nothing to do with the kind. You know, there was a girl who married a non-Christian. And she knew very well she shouldn't have done it. And you know what she did? She said, I wanted a sign from the Lord that it was pleasing to him. Hear me, you have already done what is displeasing to God, and now you want a sign from the Lord. And I said, what sign? And she said, well, you see, I asked that there might be sunshine on the day of the wedding. Well, your chances of having sunshine on the day of the wedding are statistically not too bad in any case. Yeah. So having got sunshine on the day of the wedding, she said, you see, the Lord has granted me this. Oh, dear me, brothers and sisters, into what utter delusion we come to. What pitiful situation. You need to look for this kind of external sign. How do you know somebody else wasn't praying, Lord, I want sunshine today, and somebody else saying, Lord, give me rain? And which one is God going to answer? What a ridiculous way to look for a sign. And what a pitiful way that Christians come to this pathetic state of affairs. Guidance is nowhere to be sought in this fashion. And there are others who look for guidance. The technique is apparently to have a quick flip of the Bible and stick your finger in the position and read the words there. I heard it said that somebody trying this technique ended up quite disastrously. Because somebody flipped the Bible open and stuck the finger at the point, and you know what they read there? And Judas went and hanged himself. Well, if you use that technique for guidance, you need to expect that. You see, such is the pitiful state that the church has come to, that this is what is called guidance. Or else, guidance is said to be seeking the advice of the multitude of opinions. Well, you can call that human guidance. It has absolutely nothing to do with divine guidance. There was somebody who wanted to serve the Lord with me. He had spent 3 years in Bible college, and brothers and sisters, he still doesn't know what guidance is about. And he had to face a great cost of serving the Lord with me. It meant he had to give up medicine. I didn't ask him to do it. That was his own choice. I never talked anybody into doing anything in this kind of way. Every person must make his own choice. And he longed to serve the Lord with me. And he said, I want to give up medicine. I said, before I left England to come to Canada, he came to see me once more. He's seen me many times before on this subject. And he wasn't always not too sure, and he was going to serve the Lord with me. Then he wasn't too sure, and he was going to serve the Lord again. And finally, before I left, he came to see me, and he said, I intend to serve the Lord with you. I said, well, I seem to have heard that before. The question now is, what are you going to do about it? I said, do you really mean business with God? He said, I really do mean business with God. Well, so much for his business with God. Because his mother put her foot down, and were a very simple device to knock him out of it. How? Took him to 3 pastors, all of whom said that he shouldn't give up medicine. A wonderful subject like medicine is not something that anybody gives up. And go and be a doctor, is it? You don't need to preach the gospel. I would like to see these pastors. I'd like to see who these people are. Do they love the world to that extent that somebody who knows that he is being called out to serve the Lord is going to be told, get back to your job? I'd like to see who these pastors are. I want them to give an account of themselves before God. Whatever on earth do they think they are doing? How much have they loved the world? But after all, it's not surprising. This was in Hong Kong. And doctors seem to live somewhere halfway between heaven and earth. Apparently, by the time you become a medical doctor, you're almost... You're so high up in society, in Hong Kong at least, that, I mean, nobody could conceive of the degradation of coming down to become a preacher. So what happens? The poor man is split apart. He doesn't know whether he's going to serve the Lord or he's not going to serve the Lord. That is called guidance, brothers and sisters. Is that divine guidance or human guidance? I don't think you need to be a genius to draw your own conclusion. Guidance can be dealt with quite simply in this way. There is general guidance and there is specific guidance. What exactly do we mean by general guidance? General guidance is what every Christian must have. If you are not generally guided by the Lord, you are not any Christian of any sort. Listen to Romans chapter 8 and verse 14. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. That means every son of God, every child of God is led by the Spirit. That is a condition of salvation. There's no specific guidance here. Every Christian is being led by the Spirit of God. You are being led by the Spirit of God if you are a Christian. That word led, then, from the point of view of accurate exegesis and exposition, is a word which is used exactly in the same way in the Old Testament of Israel. In Psalm chapter 18, verse 1, God is spoken of as the shepherd of Israel that leads Israel. And the word led, rather vague again in English, is what is in the original a present tense, which is continuous in its significance. As many as are constantly being led by God, these are the children of God. That is general guidance. Constantly being led by the Spirit of God. We are being led on all the time. We are not sort of standing there and occasionally needing some guidance. We are being led.